The Minnesota, Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Judge Smith, Judge Rodenberg, the Honorable Jeffrey, and Brian presiding. This is our second case, number A210543, in the supervised estate of Delbert W. Wara.
Good morning, and thank you for participating remotely. Although we're not in person, we will proceed under the same rules as if we were at the Judicial Center. As you know, the proceedings are being audio recorded. I'd ask that you state your name and the party that you represent before beginning your argument. I want to say a couple of things, though, before we begin. First off, since we're using this video conferencing platform, we understand that sometimes there are interruptions and technical difficulties, as they say. We will accommodate those to the best of our ability. In other words, if you need more time, we will pause your clock and make sure you have the time you're entitled to before our court. We also understand that there may be other types of interruptions, doorbells, pets, family members, and I don't want you to be overly anxious about those things because they do happen, and we will be understanding about them. Also, you will see a clock. That is something that if you're in the gallery view, you should be able to see no problem, but if you are switched into the active speaker view, you might not be able to see it very well. So I encourage you to use the gallery view so you know how much time is remaining. And last, I'll note that only the judges and the attorneys are permitted to speak. We've disabled the ability of other participants to share their audio and video or to make comments in the chat function. If there is at any point something you're not able to hear or see, please let us know right away. And with that, we are ready to begin.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning to counsel. My name is Michael Kemp, along with Paul Funke. We represent the estate of Delbert Wara through its personal representative, John Rodriguez. I will be arguing the case before the court. The question before the court today is whether a party who chooses not to object to an inventory or final account or to appeal a statement to close within the statutory time period may come back 12 years later to challenge that very same information and to contest it when an estate is reopened for a different purpose. The court should vacate the ruling below and hold as a matter of law that the challenge brought by respondent was time barred.
Can I start right away with that? So I think the way that this happens is there's an order in 2004 that describes basically the law of how the distribution should be made, right? $150,000 worth to spouse and then remainder split halfway. And then in 2006, there are three filings by the personal representative. I don't know that those filing, for example, if you talk about appealing from the final statement of a count. I'm not sure that if that had been appealed, I don't know what there would have been in terms of a record to challenge that because there wasn't an objection. Like normally there'd be an objection, right? And then the district court would issue an order on an objection and then that could be appealed within the time period. There was no objection here. So to me, it sort of seems like it comes down to whether there was an obligation to make an objection within a certain time period. Otherwise, I'm not sure what would be preserved for appeal. What tells us when an objection needs to be filed? Where is the statutory authority that dictates when an objection needs to be filed to a final account?
Your Honor, in this case, the final account and the inventory are by statute provided to known potential heirs. In this case of a decedent who died without a will, giving them the ability to object, the statutory period for an improper distribution is 1 year, but under 525.712 sets the appeal period for right. Any person.
And what's the appeal period from an order otherwise under five? And the first one, and you said the objection, like if I'm sitting there in 2006 and I think maybe I should object to that or 2007 or 2008, where do I look to see if my objection is timely? You're saying it's a 1 year time period? And what can you cite me to that statute that sets the 1 year time period for an objection? That's what I wanted to look at.
Yes, I can, Your Honor. In this case, it is 1 year after the distribution or 3 years after the date of death. I will pull up that is in our preliminary brief here. It's under 524.3. And in that case, it is 524.3-803. That is what sets that initial period. So in this case, I understand the court's hesitation to be that if there is a statement to close without an objection having been made in the first place, the question is what the record would be on appeal here.
Well, my question is, what statute of limitations are we looking at for purposes of your argument? And when exactly does that happen? It seems like the objection, if an objection could be made within 1 year of the date of the, whatever it was, in 2006, September, I don't remember the date, September 13th, add 1 year or add 3 years. I'm trying to figure out what precise statute do we look at to see when the objector could object and when that date was. And you're saying I will find that answer in 524.3-803.
That's correct, Your Honor. The question is to objections and to appeals, because as the court may know, estates can sometimes take quite a long period of time to close. So there may be distributions that are made on an interim basis, or distributions made to devisees or beneficiaries of an estate, but that the estate does not close until significantly later for other reasons, tax reasons, or other things like that. In that case, we have this final appeal period, and why we have drawn the line at 525.712, the 6 months, so that is the latest period of time for someone to object, is that statement to close when it is filed in 2006, closes the estate. The estate is over. Nothing else is going to happen in that
estate.
Okay,
so you're saying that even an objection needs to be made before 6 months because the appeals period is 6 months? That's what I'm trying to figure out. If we put ourselves back in time in 2006, how long did an objector have to object? And you're saying it's effectively 6 months because there's a 6 month?
No, in this case, it would have been the normal 60-day period, because that statute distinguishes between people who had notice, as respondent did in this case, who have the normal 60-day time period to object under any, under the normal protocols of the rules of appeal. However, given the fact that a aggrieved party could potentially come forward who is not somebody who had received notice, somebody who, for instance, believes they have a claim that was not addressed, they might not have gotten the notice that respondent did. The maximum period for them under that statute is 6 months. So what we are looking at, Your Honor, is that final time period that after that, nobody has the ability to bring an appeal.
Well, let me just follow up that on that, Mr. Kemp. That argument proceeds on the premise that the estate was closed back then. But we have a petition from Mr. Rodriguez saying that he, under paragraph 10, the purpose that for his needing to be appointed as successor personal representative is, among other things, to, quote, properly close the decedent's estate. So his petition seems to suggest that the estate wasn't properly closed.
No, we disagree with that, Your Honor. The estate was closed. There was a statement to close. It was properly filed. The estate was closed at that point. Then the estate had to be reopened. And the reason it had to be opened had nothing to do with the estate of Delbert Wara. The question, who is the decedent at issue here, the personal representative of that estate, Mary Lou Wara, had then herself died. And so the reason to reopen this estate was not because it had never been properly closed, but because the assets, because the Graco, the company, needed to be able to distribute the assets that she believed owned by her to her own descendants and beneficiaries.
I think we understand that, but how is it that the estate was closed? Now we get into the question, what's the scope? I think of what happens in a reopening, which is now moving into a different part of my questions about this. But I think, how was the estate closed by a final accounting if it was the distributions were not appropriately made?
The estate was not closed by the final accounting, Your Honor. The estate was closed by the statement to close.
The statement to close. Which did that statement to close say that all distributions had been made even though they hadn't been made?
The statement to close did say all distributions had been made. At that point, respondent who had notice of that statement to close had notice from the personal representative that she believed that all the beneficiaries, in this case, only herself and respondent, had received all the distributions that they were going to receive. At that point, he knew that he had received everything that was going to be granted to him. And for the next decade and more, everybody acted like that's exactly what had happened. We know, for instance, that he did know that she was receiving dividend checks because he stole several of them. He'd received these checks. He would have seen who was the payee on it as Mary Lou Wara, as personal representative of the estate. So everyone involved in this case believed that the case was closed, believed that all distributions that were going to be made had been made, and had all the information that is now used 12 years later in 2018 with respondent's petition to go back and undo those calculations. And the reason that should not be allowed is because, as we noted in our principal brief, the statute's limitations and equitable principles of laches do apply here to prevent a party who's had full notice of this all along and has acted as everyone else has, as if the estate had been properly distributed, from asserting 12 years later it has not been properly distributed.
I mean, this is an unusual case, and I do understand the arguments, but it seemed, wasn't part of the petition was to reopen, to be appointed a successor PR in order to, in fact, and the filings were done that appropriately showed the inventory and the increase in value, et cetera, to actually effectuate the distributions. It's your argument, I guess, that it closed and reopened, or maybe is your argument also, you're saying with respect to him, the distribution in 2006 said that he'd get zero, and in fact, he got zero, that he can't challenge the fact that the distribution wasn't effectively made to his mother?
The second part is closer to what we are arguing, Your Honor. First off, we'll come back to you. The estate was closed. There's no question that the estate was closed per the statutory process and remained closed for close to 12 years. So that is not an issue. The issue of whether there was a proper distribution from the estate to Ms. Wara is not, in the end, something that gives respondent here a private right of action for breach of fiduciary duty 12 years ago, which is how his claim was styled. This was a claim for breach of fiduciary duty, which is a collateral attack on that initial statement to close and judicial process. So the distribution in this case was made by the fact that there was a statement to close explaining to each of the parties who had an interest what the distribution was. You can look at those numbers and see that based on the marital share at the time of $150,000, the advances to the estate of $4,000, and the total estate value or the shared value of $153,000, that respondent was not going to be entitled to any of the share of the estate because there was nothing left after the marital share. And he was given notice of that.
Mr. Kemp,
Rodenberg, you look like you were about to ask me a question.
Go ahead, Judge Rodenberg.
Oh, well, I did have one question, and it seems like Ms. Wara herself acknowledged by receipt dated September 11th of 2006 that she did receive those shares, but in fact, she did not receive those shares. Is that right?
She had retitled the shares from the name of the decedent, Delbert Wara, into her own name, but had added as personal representative of the estate of Delbert Wara, which all the parties appeared to believe had correctly retitled that to her as an individual, or that she was then individually allowed to continue receiving the income checks from these, from distributions, and making sales of the shares.
Mr. Kemp, if I can, as I hear you, you engaging with Judge Smith about what your argument is, and it's slightly different than how I understood it. So as I look at this process, there was a request subsequent to the closing to appoint a successor personal representative for the sole purpose of retitling those shares so that once correctly titled, they are now within the estate that Mr. Rodriguez is now the personal representative for to handle. So there's a provision in the statute about subsequent administration post the closing of an estate. And it seemed, when I understood your briefs, it seemed to me that you were really looking at that statute, not some common law laches argument that up until this point hasn't been applied in this way, but really that provision of the statute at 524.3-1008, especially the last sentence, which says no claim previously barred may be asserted in the subsequent administration. And that's how I interpreted this, the framing of this argument, is that we're in this procedure that applies subsequent to closing. And in that procedure, it's simply, there is no way for somebody who had a claim but didn't raise it to now raise it once a new personal representative has been appointed. Am I misunderstanding your argument or not?
No, Your Honor, and I see my time has expired. Let me briefly answer your question and then conclude into rebuttal. Your Honor, our argument is a statutory one, that the appeals period or objection period has simply expired. There are no other principles the court needs to reach to grant the primary request of appellant here, which is that the judgment or the order be vacated and the objection dismissed as time barred. However, respondent has raised a number of issues, including, as you've seen from respondent's brief, that Mary Lou Wara, for instance, was lying to her son that she had committed perjury, fraud under oath.
Right, but all of those things are claims that when it comes to fraud, that would have potentially been an exception to laches, but it doesn't seem like the statute at 1008 includes those exceptions. It says no claim previously barred may be asserted. So that's why I was maybe you can address that in rebuttal.
Understood, Your Honor. Okay. Thank you.
All right, and now we'll switch to respondent. Is it Loper?
Loper.
All right, go ahead, Mr. Loper.
Well, we've spent a lot of time talking about the statement to close the estate and the so-called final account, which were all, to a degree, fraudulent because they weren't true. The personal representative had not fully administered the estate. She had not filed a proper inventory. She had undervalued the inventory in the original estate by about 35%.
Counsel, can I ask, let's pretend for a moment that there was not a petition to reopen here.
Yes.
And let's also pretend for a moment that the distribution was rightly made after 2006. And the share, in other words, the share, they were retitled in Ms. Wara's name. Okay. So all that exists is what happened in 2006. And then at, and then, you know, in 2019, Glenn Wara ascertains, oh, that actually was wrong. Could he object at that point?
Well,
or is it time barred?
I think he could have objected, because all of a sudden there was an estate that was represented to be $150,000, $153,000, now worth $800,000. And, you know, what one does when one has notice of an action depends on what knowledge he has of the underlying facts. And the underlying facts were all provided by Mrs. Wara, who undervalued the original inventory, did not update the account.
There's no statute of or limitations period on an objector who, after final account, let's even assume just a fraudulent final account or a mistake in a final account, whatever it is, that it undervalues something. You're saying at any point in time,
well,
once someone learns of that, they can object.
You have to have knowledge of some impropriety in order to create a claim or assert a claim on behalf of that. When you're told by your mother that the estate is worth $153,000, when she subsequently says that she's fully administered it, when she submits an account that does not include any increases in the estate, even though we know that the estate by 2006 or the shares by 2006 were worth $325,000. How do you know you should file an objection? The fact is that the personal representative is a fiduciary with an obligation to look out for the best interests of not only herself, but the other people who are interested in the estate. And when she affirmatively conceals the value of these assets, I don't know how you know, or how an interested party would know that this misrepresentation or these misrepresentations have taken place.
Can I ask counsel, and it might be there, and I could easily just not have missed it. Did your client then? I mean, there was a petition to reopen by Mr. Rodriguez. Did your client also petition to reopen on the basis of there having been fraud or a breach of fiduciary duty?
No.
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 Is that right?
That's correct. We filed objections to the plan of, to the final account and to the plan of distribution that contradicted the plan of distribution announced by the court in 2004. Pursuant to the statute.
To the question of whether your client could or would or should have made an objection back when, Graco is a very large company. It's publicly traded, right?
It is.
And he knew that, or at least the paperwork reflects that there were 4,863 shares of Graco stock, right?
Say that again, how many?
4,863.
Yes, yeah, that was the initial inventory. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, if
but they were undervalued,
I could, with a couple quick clicks of the mouse here, I could find out what Graco is selling at today. That's not difficult to figure out.
Well,
I could have figured it out.
Perhaps, but he's certainly not as sophisticated as you are, and.
Don't give me too much credit for being sophisticated when it comes to trading stocks. But it's publicly available information and could have been ascertained. You agree with that?
it is public information. And one could take the share value on a given date and multiply it by the number of shares and come up with a number. And in fact, that's how I discovered that the shares were undervalued in the initial inventory, because I couldn't make the accounts, any of them. The supplemental account filed by the new personal representative balance with the numbers that were there. And so I went to estate valuation and pricing, and I got an official, if you will, pricing that showed that those shares were worth about $207,000 instead of
$153,000. Can I ask this is perhaps a small question, but there was only one inventory filed in 2006, right? There was no supplemental inventory.
No, as far as I know, the only inventory that was ever filed was the inventory in 2006.
Right. Okay. And that inventory asks for value at the date of death.
Yes.
From 2004. And yes. And then later there is a final account which
asks. Well, they were all filed at the same time.
Exactly. And the final account asks for any increases, presumably since the date of death, and it doesn't.
Yes.
So was the mistake, this is kind of a small question. You're saying the mistake was from the value even at the date of death. Is
yes.
that right? At the date of death.
Absolutely.
Okay. Then they were worth 200 plus thousand. Okay.
Yeah. And of course, our position is founded on the statute that says that the assets of an estate devolve to the heirs, in this case, or devisees, immediately on the death of the decedent. The personal representative has the right to use those assets to make certain distributions and pay claims and do things like that if necessary, but the property belongs to the heirs on the date of death.
Right. I was just wondering, I mean, 2 years later, if in 2 years, for example, between 2004, the value of the stock, and 2006, when it's to be distributed, if the stock had increased in value at that point, I suppose that you would think that your client, that at distribution, the increase should be taken into account, right? At distribution.
Yeah, it should be listed as an increase.
And
as
an increase. Okay. And if it had decreased below 150,000 at the date of distribution, there had been a crash. And now it's like 5 cents,
sure.
Then the decrease applies. Okay.
Well, or because of claims that were necessary to be paid by the estate or other things. I mean, the accounting function, as I understand it, is list the inventory. If there were items missed, add those in under increases, add in the income that those assets earn while they're held by the estate, and then come up with your final account. It's a starting place, increases, decreases, balance on hand for distribution. And
can I ask if we were to conclude that the reopening of it actually permitted a reexamination and a correction of the value at the date of death and or the date of distribution, whatever it is, at 2004, 2006, and that why wouldn't the appropriate settlement of that then be just to look at the relative percentages that mom and son had of the remainder of the stock and actually just carry that forward, sort of similar to when you figure out in a divorce case, like a Schmitz formula, what percentage should you get of current value? Why wouldn't that be the normal way to look at it? If he was entitled to like 13% of the value then, why don't we figure out 13% of the value now?
Well, I think that's what, in effect, you do. The legislature screwed this up a little bit by putting that dollar figure, in this case, at that time, $150,000. And then when you have assets that have a market value and go up and down and do other things, that complicates the calculation of a percentage. I mean, the statute talks both in terms of a percentage and a dollar amount, and that complicates things to some degree. And that's why Mrs. Wara said, well, you know, there's only $153,000 worth of value here, so it's all mine. And that sounds reasonable when you say it that way. But of course, there was $207,000 there then, and it's continued to increase to the point where there's more than $1 million.
No, I get that. I mean, if in fact it had only been worth $149,000, the stock,
yeah,
it would have been right. It would have all gone to mom. And the fact that that increased in value, there'd be no complaint that Glenn Wara could have. Could there be?
No, I think that's probably true. But the
problem was that it was actually worth more. And so there should have been, let's use some round numbers. Let's say it was worth $200,000. And she would get the first $150,000 worth, and that would leave $50,000 to divide between them. $25,000 is what he'd get. $25,000 is an eighth of the $200,000. Why wouldn't he get entitled to an eighth of what there is now? But he got a lot more than that.
Well, you know, he's entitled to 50% of the balance remaining after the payment of the $150,000. That all
right,
of the
assets,
been
$25,000 under my hypo, under using a number of $200,000, that would be $25,000 worth of stock.
Yeah, you can play that game for sure. But the fact of the matter is that the assets, the stock, was owned by Mrs. Wara and Glenn Wara on the date of death. And the fact is it was worth more than $150,000. So she was not entitled to take the whole amount of the shares. And if she had been honest when she filed the final account, she would have increased the value of the shares to $325,000. But she didn't.
Mr. Loper, if I could interrupt as your time is running down, I want to move us away from the discussion of, you know, the math part of this and apples to apples and making sure mm-hmm. we're going to use the cash value to reduce an award that we're making things consistent. I want to move away from that if I can, because as your last response kind of indicated, and as your interaction with Judge Smith earlier indicated, it seems that you are arguing that the 2004 and 2006 statement and accounting, that those were fraudulent. And so I guess I see two different...
They were at least untrue.
Let me finish. Right, because that's a big distinction. So in terms of whether there's whether the claim or the objection has been time barred, it seems to me that simply being untrue is not going to be enough to get around the requirement. You have to prove fraud. At least that's how I understand it. But as I look at the brief, it seems like you might also be arguing the mere fact of reopening for any purpose triggers a renewed right to object for any other purpose. So which is it? Are you saying that there was fraud, or are you saying that the act of reopening triggers any renewal of a right to object, or both?
Well, I think I'm saying both, but certainly this is a new consideration here. There's all of a sudden $827,000 or something at the time.
Right. Well, it's not all of a sudden. The stock market changed.
Well, yes.
So let me ask, to be very precise, what authority is there that allows a right to object when something has been reopened? Where is that in the statute? For any purpose, not fraud, but any purpose at all. Generally, you have a renewed right. Where is that?
I mean, he filed an account, and there's a universal right, and I can't give you the site right at the at the moment, but it universally done that when there's an account, the people who are interested in the estate have the right to file objections and get it done right.
Thank you very much.
Can I ask one question, Judge Bryan?
Yes.
What are we to make of the last clause of 524.3-1008 that no claim previously barred may be asserted in a subsequent administration?
Well, I mean, this is what they're talking about, I think, is what the appellant argued is collateral estoppel. But I don't think this is collateral estoppel. I think this is the same estate with more money than everybody thought it had. And the statute that says that on death, the heirs become the owners of that property.
Well, but you really haven't responded to my question, I don't think. In a subsequent administration, no claim previously barred may be asserted. Do you agree with that?
That's the law.
Yeah. So how do you get around that?
Well, that assumes it was barred. I mean, this is a new administration based on new evidence, new value that's been discovered that the successor personal representative can't do anything without the authority of the probate court. So the jurisdiction of the probate court is asserted to empower him now to step back in and do what should have been done back in 2006, that is to fully administer and distribute the estate.
Thank you very much, Mr. Loper. Rebuttal, Mr. Kemp.
Thank you, Your Honor. And Judge Bryan, before I get to the point that you had posed to me at the end of my principal argument, I want to begin with the point that I think all three of the judges were asking at the end of Mr. Loper's argument. The question is there a mere right if there is a subsequent administration in the estate to open it for any purpose and correct any errors from a decade or more before? I want to start out by pointing out that in this case, the bequest was, well, the succession, I should say, there was no bequest, was from a husband to a wife, and they died 12 years apart. The same argument advanced by Mr. Loper would also be true if, for instance, a grandfather he gave a gift to his granddaughter, and 60 years later, she died, and this court, the district courts or the probate courts, would be in the position of unwrapping something that had happened 60 years before. Now, this is especially problematic when, as is true in this case, the respondent had all the information that was necessary to make the objection that is being made now. It is absolutely untrue that there's new value here. There's no new evidence at all.
Can I ask Mr. Kemp, this sort of goes to my question. What role, if any, do you think, we were talking about 524.3-1008, which deals with when property of the state is omitted or discovered and what happens with that, and there's a subsequent administration. And then it says at the end, no claim previously barred may be asserted. If there were some new property discovered or omitted in this past estate, are we even in this world of 1008? Are we even talking about the discovery or the omission of property?
The argument that we have always advanced is this is not new property. This is not omitted property. The property was clearly listed, 4,863 shares, which is exactly what there were at the time. And that gets, I think, to Judge Bryan's question at the end of the principal argument, which was, do we have to get into equitable questions like laches, or do we have statutory time periods which at law bar respondents' claim? And here we do. We mentioned 524.3-803, which prevents claims against the estate after a certain time period. We also put in our brief 524.3-1006.
Mr. Kemp, are these, when you say claims, I just want to interrupt because I want to make sure I understand. We've been saying objection, and the statute says claim. Are those the same thing?
They're not, Your Honor. And because the question of how the claim, I'm using the term generally here, is presented, will govern the different time periods. That's why I'm listing off these different time periods. So 803 generally deals with, and you can see from the statute, generally deals with claims of creditors. Under Article 3, 1006 deals with actions against a distributee. In other words, is there a right to recover improperly distributed distributions? 1008, as Judge Smith just pointed out, deals with new or omitted property. And 525.712 deals with the appeals period.
Which of those have exceptions for fraud? Because as I look at the statute, there's definitely some exceptions for fraud, misrepresentation, or inadequate disclosure under 524.3-1005, 524.3-1006 has an exception for fraud. And so the one that I see that didn't seem to have an exception for fraud is 1008, and maybe it's baked into previously time barred. So I guess I'm really trying to figure out how important these allegations of fraud are, and whether or not instead there's a statutory right that is renewed absent fraud.
To answer the two parts of your question, I see I'm going to run past my time to answer that, Your Honor, with the court's permission. The questions of which are affected by fraud, in this case, you can look at the statute and those particular ones, depending on how the claim is presented, are the issue. So the under 1005, for instance, a claim against the personal representative would be a claim against Mary Lou Wara. Our position would be that would be a personal claim, and she has since died. The issues of fraud in this case are interesting for one particular reason, and that's Mary Lou Wara has died. She died more than six years ago. There is no way for the current personal representative to present evidence showing why she did.
Let me ask this question, because I think it's more important than your argument about whether it could be proven. I didn't see any findings regarding fraud in the various district court orders. So I guess the question becomes, what evidence was presented regarding fraud? I know you're saying that there's no way to prove it, but what was presented?
There was no evidence presented of fraud on the part of Mary Lou Wara. Glenn Wara committed some forgery, but as far as Mary Lou Wara, there was no evidence presented. There was evidence presented that at most she had mistakenly set the wrong value of these shares. And for that reason, Your Honor, this court should vacate the order and dismiss the objection, or in the alternative, because all of these valuation questions show the issues that are presented if you do not vacate and dismiss that claim. Then the court should at the very least reverse and remand for proper valuation of any claims in the order of what Judge Smith was talking about. Thank you, Your Honors.
I want to thank you both for your arguments and for your written submissions. We will issue